mindfulness and these delightful breaths and all these amazing things. It does sound so easy. And it can be easy if one is skillful. But a lot of the times, because of old habits and just basically the way that we deal with things in life, in the world, we try to apply the same techniques to meditation, and it doesn't work. Meditation is quite different to how you succeed in life. So because of that, that we do have difficulties and problems in our meditation, and focusing at all specifically on the sort of things which will occur in meditation, how to overcome them, can actually help, which means that you won't have to spend so much time being frustrated, and you have more time enjoying the peace, the stillness, and the joy of meditation, which is immense. So obviously the first hindrance to meditation is not doing it. In other words, wasting time doing other things. So it's really important you're on this meditation retreat, so please give the importance, you know, to sitting and walking and to meditating, to see how much time you can spend on your meditation cushion, on your chair, how much time you can spend on the walking. Because obviously the more you nurture the peaceful mind, the more peaceful it's going to become. So number one, it's a waste of time dealing with the problems in meditation if you hardly ever spend time meditating. So please, spend as much time as you can. And I know that sometimes the body gets tired or it gets sore, but please make use of the chairs or the cushions. That's what they're here for. And if you find the room is too cold in the afternoon because the aircon is on, or it's too hot because the aircon is not cold enough, you can always meditate in your rooms. And if you find even that's too hot, the bathrooms are beautiful places to meditate. Get a couple of cushions and actually meditate in there. And if you're still hot, meditate under the shower. Turn the cold water on, you're nice and cool. So be innovative in where you meditate. And if you like meditating outside, there's so many places to meditate. And if you haven't found it yet, there is a secret Buddha garden somewhere in this compound. And if you know where it is, it's a nice little place to meditate outside. Sometimes, obviously, in the middle of the afternoon, it's a bit hot out there, but at night time or early in the morning, it's beautiful to meditate at those places or meditate on the stupa. My job of setting this place up is to give you as much opportunity as possible to do the meditation so you can put in the time. And when you put in the time, lots of hours meditating, that solves a lot of problems, because sooner or later the mind will become still. You're inclining it towards stillness, which after a while the mind will just submit and become very still. So that's one of the first problems, is not putting enough time into the meditation. And the second problem is when you do the meditation, please follow the instructions. When the instructions are pretty clear, all you need to do is sit there, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And there is a new t-shirt. Danny, you can might as well stand up now. Only came this day, another Jhana Grove t-shirt with the words, make peace, be kind, be gentle on it. Just to remind everybody, total brainwashing. Which is actually all you ever need to do to meditate. So even if you feel sick, if you feel tired, if you feel fed up, no matter what you're experiencing during this retreat, just remember those three words, make peace, be kind, be gentle. It means that the meditation is so simple. Years ago, somebody asked me, but you know, sometimes I've got this sickness, I've got this ache, this arthritis, and it just makes it so difficult to meditate. And I asked them, can you make peace with your arthritis? They said, well, yeah, I suppose I can do that. Can you be kind to it? Yes. Can you be gentle with it? Yes. Then you can meditate. And that wasn't just like a second-class meditation for people who were sick or old. This was first-class meditation. This is the essence of it. So it doesn't matter what you're experiencing on this retreat. Don't think, oh, it's not nimittas, it's not jhanas, therefore I'm failing. No, you can always, any time, you can always make peace with what you're experiencing. You can always be kind to this experience. And you can always be gentle. That means you can always meditate. Because meditation is not what you're experiencing. Meditation is not about being able to watch the breath or be able to watch nimittas or be able to be in jhanas. Meditation is what you're doing with what you're experiencing. You're building up the causes for deep meditation. You're making peace, being kind, being gentle. So the only reason we get frustrated is when we keep judging ourselves. We're judging ourselves. I'm only at this stage. I'm only at that stage. And please don't do that. The only thing you should do is not to judge, but just to make peace, be kind, be gentle. It's another way of letting go. It's not judging. And you all know by now, especially after last night, telling you about the emptiness of this universe, that I'm really into science and physics. And some years ago, somebody asked me just to comment on a saying by one of the great scientists and the founders of what we call the modern technology, the Industrial Revolution in Europe, a fellow called Lord Kelvin. And he once was quoted as saying, "The only way we can control nature is to learn how to measure her accurately, first of all." And it was a great insight in science, which meant you had to have standard measurements of length, of time, of weight, and only when you could actually standardize the measurements could we have actually technology. And anyone inside who knows their science knows that this is, you know, of such an important thing to do. So to begin the technological revolution, these scientists spent a lot of time in debates and conferences working out standard ways of measuring things. And so when they asked me to comment about that, I just, you know, turned it around and say that when you don't measure things, you can't control them. Measuring is a means of control. Which is why the governments have censuses every few years to measure you. Why they get all your information on Facebook. Why they do all this other stuff, because it's measurement gives you the means to control. So what happens when you stop measuring? It means you can't control it anymore. You have to let go. So that's a great way of letting go. Stop measuring things. And in particular, stop measuring your meditation. How's it gone so far on this retreat? Are you happy with your progress? Or are you really fed up and think, my God, I better get my act together, only 4 or 5 days to go. This is hopeless. Now, that measuring is the cause of the problem. It's not the solution. Even measuring one meditation, is this peaceful? Is this restless? What is it? That is not the solution. That is the cause of the problem. So stop measuring. You're right here, right now. Is this good? Is this bad? I don't know. Who cares? This moment has arrived. I am not going to judge it. Instead, I'm just going to make peace with it, be kind with it, be gentle with it, and not judge it at all. On this retreat, have you had better meditations you've ever had before? Or nowhere near as good as you had before? Stop measuring. Because once you measure, yeah, it's a great meditation. What happens next? You want a better meditation, or at least the same. And some of you have had that problem already. You've had some good meditation. I can't get it back again. I want it back again. Why can't I get it back again? You've been measuring again. Stop measuring good meditation, bad meditation. But even worse, people get really frustrated. They haven't had any good meditation at all. And the question time in the evening, when someone says, oh, I just went into a beautiful meditation, brilliant night, sucked in, really still, really peaceful. For some of you, that really sucks. This is unfair. So again, that's more measuring. So, one of the biggest problems in meditation, the biggest hindrances, what stops you being peaceful, is measuring. Stop judging. That is part of the world. It is not part of meditation. Whatever you're experiencing, respect it. Be kind to it. Open the door of your heart to this moment, no matter what it is, without any good or bad, without any giving it a grade out of 10. Don't do that. Just let it be. Make peace with it. Be kind with it. And be gentle with it. No measuring. If you can do that, you find your meditation becomes so peaceful. When you don't measure anything, you've got nothing to strive towards. You just can't get a handle on achievement anymore. Which means instead of trying to get somewhere, instead of trying to change things, it's not good enough, you've measured again. Instead of having all these stages of meditation, you have to tick off. Yes, I've done stage one, tick. Stage two, tick. Stage three, tick. That's why they have an English, it really ticks you off. You don't do such stuff. It really is, it just controls you, and you never actually get all the ticks. You never actually reach the end of achievement. There's always something more to achieve. So let it all go. No measuring. Which means you just all you can do is just be here. You've got no place to go anymore. There's no goals to reach. There's no more destinations. You go to the airport and no plane is going anywhere. You're stuck. You're here. Well done. So this is one way of overcoming the deepest of problems in meditation. Stop measuring. But then sometimes you'll say, well, stop measuring, I just don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on. It's just like being in a car without a GPS. And the way to overcome that, because after you stop measuring, sometimes people get what we call doubt, which again is one of the biggest of the hindrances and the obstacles. Basically, what am I supposed to be doing? And what you're supposed to be doing is becoming more still, more peaceful, more awake. So if you do feel you're becoming still, you are going in the right direction. Okay, there's a little bit of measuring, but it happens when you stop measuring, then you become still. When you try to become still, you become agitated. And there's a simile which I've been using in my meditation retreats over the past couple of years. The simile of overcoming this doubt, not really knowing what you're supposed to be doing. Am I going in the right direction? It's wonderful if you can totally stop measuring and then you're automatically you go in the right direction. You become very still, very peaceful. You know it's the right direction. But for those of you who want a little bit more handle on what meditation is and whether you're doing it correctly or not correctly, the simile of when I was a student, I would spend many of my vacations in the Scottish Highlands. You know, I was down in London, and it was only just, you know, a day's hitchhiking. You're up in the north of Scotland, and you get your tent and a backpack, and off you go, spending days by yourself meditating in the mountains. It's a very beautiful part of the world in summertime. And one occasion, I was staying in a youth hostel, and with the warden, who was a local guy who should have known better, we went to walk up to the top of one of the mountains. It's not a tall mountain, it'd take 2 or 3 hours to get to the top. And when we got to the top, it was such a beautiful day, you know, not a cloud in the sky, nice and sunny and warm and gorgeous weather. There was another mountain a couple of miles away, so I said, let's go to the other mountain. He said, no, one's enough for me, I'm going back to the hostel. And so he let me walk up the other mountain by myself, and that was really his mistake, because in that part of the world, in any wilderness area, you should never go by yourself. You should always have someone with you. Because what happened, it's only just maybe half an hour's time, clouds came over, and by the time I got to the top of the mountain, I was enveloped in mist. Totally sort of enveloped. And it was such thick mist, I couldn't see the hand in front of me. And that's why you should always be with someone else. It was dangerous. And you always think that you can retrace your steps. You think you have a sense of direction. But I found out you don't. Because I went in totally the opposite direction I thought I was going. Because I came to a cliff One more step and I would not be here. And it was a vertical cliff going many hundreds of meters down. Later on, when I checked on the maps, I had gone 180 degrees in the opposite direction than I thought I was walking in, because I could see where that cliff was. And that scared me, because no, one step, literally, and I would have been dead. And so I realized I was in a dangerous situation, couldn't see in front of me, and was lost on top of the mountains. And sometimes when the mist comes down, it stays there for days. And I was, you know, remember them telling me a story of about three or four people who was lost on this moor in Scotland for about 4 or 5 days. You know, without food, just wandering around, until eventually they found their way out. So there I was, lost on top of the mountain, and wondering, what should I do to escape? And at least I had some intelligence that I realized, if I could find a little stream and follow the stream, water always goes downhill. I've never seen water go up. So, I'm going to find the stream and follow it. And that means I'd always be going down, 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 whichever direction. And when you go down far enough, you go underneath the mist, and so you'll be able to see your directions. And so that's what I did. I followed the stream, followed it, as it snaked this way and that way, until eventually I came underneath the cloud cover, could see my directions and find my way back. And that was a simile I've used to overcome doubt in meditation, or in life, in spirituality. You can't see the big destination yet. You don't see, you know, like enlightenment, nirvana, full peace. That maybe is a bit too far. But you know that if you follow things which go downhill, you know eventually you'll come below the cloud cover of doubt. You'll be able to see everything. You know that if whatever you're doing is creating more peace, more stillness, more relaxation, more sense of contentment, you must be going in the right direction. And I've used that for teaching people to overcome their doubt. What is the right type of meditation for you? What works for you? What you've done so far, does it make you more peaceful? More still? More clear? More content? If it is, it's going in the right direction. Carry on. If what you're doing makes you more frustrated, more pain, more tense, more angry, you must be going in the wrong direction. So stop it and turn around. Follow the stream, because it will always go downhill, little by little. Follow the meditation, which is more peace, more stillness, more sense of freedom, more sense of contentment. You know what those positive qualities are. You know it must be going in the right direction. Keep going, because it does lead to the deepest of meditations and the deepest of insights and truth. That is how you will know. But if you get more tight, more tense, more frustrated, you must be going in the wrong direction. So stop it, reassess, and try something else. That is even why there are times on this retreat you meditate, it's just not working. You know one of the best ways to short circuit when it's just not working? Because people often come to me in retreats for their interviews. They say, look, I'm just having a terrible day. I'm just doing everything you said, Ajahn Brahm, but nothing's working. I'm getting more and more tense. I say, look, go into your room. Lay on your bed. Go to sleep. But I've already slept so much today. Go in your room, lay on your bed, and go to sleep. But I can't do that. Go in your room. Don't set your alarm clock. Just have a nap. When you get up, have a shower, have a cup of tea, or a cup of juice, whatever you like, and then come and see me afterwards. And that technique, 100% success rate. We always come back afterwards. I found one of the best meditation of the whole retreat. Thank you so much. And you know why? It's because we're trying too hard. You just needed to relax a bit, to let go, to be kind to your body. And then when you relax, easy, meditation gets very still. So little things like that, you realize that after you've had a good rest, you feel good. You're going in the right direction. But when you're tense, 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 you're going in the wrong direction. Don't keep pushing. Never use willpower. Always wisdom power. Because willpower is absolutely stupid. Willpower is what US Marines use. And you know what they do in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and all this. They didn't go to Iran, thank goodness. But, you know, when you go in there with force, you create more problems than when you began. Go in there with wisdom. And you'll find it so easy to overcome these problems. But there's always these problems which come up, these negative thoughts, or you get into a bad state of mind, or you get aches and pains, or bad memories, or you can't stop thinking. One of the best stories which really helps overcoming a whole heap of problems in meditation is the story from the Udana of the demon who came into the emperor's palace. Now, many of you know this story, but it is so powerful for meditation. The story was that one day the emperor was away on some sort of business, and into the palace came a monster. And this monster was so frightening, so terrifying, that the guards and soldiers, whose job it was to defend the palace, they froze in terror, allowing this monster to walk right through the palace, into the main hall, and sit on the emperor's throne. At which point, the soldiers and the ministers as well sort of woke up and said, "Get out of here! Who do you think you are? You don't belong in this place. Get out!" At which point, the monster grew an inch bigger, more frightening, more smelly, and more of a problem. And so, the soldiers, they started to get out their swords and their clubs and threaten this monster. But every unkind word, unkind deed, or unkind thought, the monster just grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. Until, when the emperor came back, the monster was huge. It was just taking up half of the hall. It was a monstrous monster. And was so frightening, was so ugly, that not even Hollywood could come up with anything so frightening and scary. Apparently the aliens were the most scariest of monsters. I've never seen aliens, don't see what. But apparently, was aliens the scariest monster from Hollywood? Yeah. Okay. Well, imagine aliens times 1,000. And that's what this monster looked like. Really terrifying. And the smell, the stench coming off this monster was so sickening that even the maggots crawling over his body threw up and were sick. I made that one up. I was actually quite proud of that. And the language was so terrible coming off this monster. And the reason why this guy was the emperor was because he knew wisdom power, not willpower. Willpower is, get out of here, you don't belong. Wisdom power was saying, welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit. Why, it's been such a long time since you last dropped in. Would you like a cup of tea? We have Sri Lankan tea. Good Theravada tea. We have green tea from China, which is Mahayana. We have peppermint tea. It may be good for your health. Would you like milk, sugar, or condensed milk? Which is very nice, is what I have. Would you like some biscuits with that? Or would you like some sandwiches? And the emperor was actually quite kind. You know what happened at those few kind words and kind deeds? The monster grew an inch smaller. Less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And everyone in the palace realized their mistake. So instead of giving the monster anger, get out of here, you don't belong, they gave it kindness. About a dozen of them came round one of the monster's big feet to give the monster a foot massage. It had such monstrous foot, it took about 12 people to massage one foot. And you know, it's very rare that monsters get, you know, reflexology. And it was just really loved it. Just over there. It was just like, ooh, that's really nice. Thank you so much. Someone else asked him, want something to eat? A pizza? Because they get monster-sized pizzas, you know, from the pizza's delivery. So they rang out for a monster pizza for the the monster. And they were so kind to this monster. Every kind act, deed, even kind thought, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. So in hardly any time at all, the monster was back to the size when he first came in. But they carried on with the kindness. And soon the monster was so tiny that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And that was a story told by the Buddha in the Udana. And I, you know, of course I added the thing about the foot massage and the pizzas and a few other bits and pieces, but it's basically that story. And the Buddha called that an anger-eating monster. You give it anger and it grows an inch bigger, uglier, more smelly, more of a problem. Now you can understand most of the problems in your meditation are called anger-eating demons. Get out of here, you don't belong, I'm supposed to be meditating. And what happens? The problem gets bigger, uglier, more smelly, more offensive. So you may have like a train of thought. I don't want to think this. Get out of here. I'm supposed to be meditating. You're sleepy. I don't want to be sleepy. I've slept all day. Get out of here, sloth and torpor. You get an ache in the body. Oh, I'm fed up with this ache. Get out of here, ache in my leg. Get out of here. And what happens? The restlessness gets worse. The sloth and torpor gets even more dull. The pain, the problem does get worse. So, please remember the demon in the emperor's palace. You're the emperor, your mind is your palace, and these bad energies, bad thoughts, whatever you think they are, they're in there and you think they don't belong. Get out of here. That is the problem. Ill will. So instead, say welcome. Thank you, sloth and torpor, for coming to visit me. I love you, sloth and torpor. And let yourself be sleepy. Welcome it. And you'll find every act of kindness you do to your sloth and torpor, the sloth and torpor gets an inch smaller, less of a problem. And you're so kind to it, it gets so small that it vanishes totally away. Sloth and torpor is an anger-eating demon. Restless thoughts, think about all sorts of things. Get out of here. I don't want to think like that. Restlessness is also an anger-eating demon. It gets bigger and gets worse the more you try and stop it. So welcome it. Welcome your restlessness. Thank you, restlessness, for coming to be with me. And to your surprise, it will get less, inch by inch by inch by inch. But you have to welcome it with kindness, properly. If you come and say, welcome restlessness, welcome, why haven't you gone away yet? That's not welcoming it. That's welcoming it, trying to get rid of it. You know, that's sort of being false. It's fraudulent kindness. I'm kind to you as long as you get out of here. That's not being kind. So it has to be the real thing. Welcome, my restless mind. Thank you for visiting me. And then you'll find the restlessness will get less and less and less and less. The biggest problem with meditators in our modern world is ill will. We have all these goals we want to reach, and we don't get there and we're fed up. Here we'll get out of here, I want to be somewhere else. Welcome where you are. Be kind to this moment. Be kind to yourself. Don't judge your meditation. You're more than good enough. That's why that's the only word I know in many languages. Good enough. Bagus sakali. Indonesian. Bahoma Hondai. Sri Lankan. Very good. Dimark. Thai. And again, Juwayo. Korean. How do you say very good in Portuguese? That's a bit long. Whatever it is, you know what I mean. Because that means that you're kind to everything. So those of you who come on the interviews already, how many of you have I scolded? I said, you stupid meditator. God, I don't know why I let you come on this retreat. You're hopeless. I've never done that, never will do that. And there is a good reason, because I will not judge you, and I don't expect you to judge yourself. I expect to welcome the monsters, not to try and get rid of them. Because I know that is how they get smaller and start to disappear. So whatever problem you have in your meditation, don't give it ill will, give it kindness. And those of you who are really going crazy, because sometimes people come up to me, you know, especially in the interviews, they want a special interview, they say, I'm going crazy, I'm going to leave, I can't stand this any longer. They've got every hindrance which ever was, and some new ones as well, which have never been invented or seen before, I've got them all. They're going mad, crazy. And so, if you really get into trouble in this meditation retreat, you're really going up the wall and you can't stand any longer, you can't sit, you can't walk, you can't do anything, you've had so many cups of tea, you're bursting with tea. No, don't go and tell me to have a rest again. I'm fed up with my bed. I spend all the time in there. I'm fed up with this place. Can't meditate, can't sleep, can't drink tea, I'm always going to the toilet. What am I going to do? And when you have the attack of all the hindrances, when you're really going crazy, that is when I used an old story from Buddhism, which anyone who's been to Buddhist Sunday school when they were kids know the story, of Nalagiri. And I call this the Nalagiri strategy. Because in the time of the Buddha, there were some people who didn't like the Buddha. Just like anybody, whenever you sort of put your head up, someone wants to shoot it off. So even the Buddha had his enemies, and they tried to kill him. And one of the ways they tried to kill him, they knew the Buddha was going to come on arms round the following morning, down the narrow streets of one of these old cities in India. And they got one of these huge king's elephants, and they made the elephant drunk. And when elephants get drunk, they go crazy. And they let the elephant loose in the early morning in the path which they knew the Buddha was coming on. So this huge elephant, like a tank, was just smashing everything in its path, charging just like a tank, destroying everything. And the people were running away. They were jumping up over the railings, over the walls, climbing up the trees. And as they were running, the Buddha with his monks were walking so peacefully and mindfully in the opposite direction. Get out of the way, there's a wild elephant coming! And the Buddha just mindfully walking. Get out of the way, the elephant's going to kill you! And according to the story, all the monks, all the peaceful, wise, compassionate monks, jumped over the walls, climbed the trees, ran away. And later on there's a book called Melinda Panha. And Melinda Panha was supposed to be this Greek king, and he became a Buddhist, and he was asking all these questions. He read all the books, but he'd ask tough questions. He said, look, these were supposed to be enlightened monks. Why did they run away? And this really smart attic monk, who was really sort of clever, he said, they ran away so that only the Buddha and Ananda will be left. So Ananda had the chance to make merit, because they knew that if they stayed behind there, they wouldn't be able to make merit and there wouldn't be such a good story. So they ran away, not because they were afraid, because they knew what was going to happen. They wanted the story to unfold. That's what he said. But anyway, they all ran away except for Ananda. And Ananda was the chief disciple of the Buddha. He loved the Buddha. He was always attending on him. And Ananda, according to the story, walked in front of the Buddha. "Let the elephant kill me. I will sacrifice my life for my master." Wasn't that really cute? And I often say, like on this retreat, "Leo, you're my attendant. Would you do that for me? Would you say, if there's a wild kangaroo coming..." Actually, kangaroos aren't that wild. You're pretty safe. But anyway, it was a very sweet thing to do. And so the Buddha pushed Ananda. "Very good, Ananda. Look, it's very nice of you, but I can look after this myself." Which must have been a bit down for Ananda not to be able to sacrifice himself. So he pushed him out of the way. Until that's all there was. Just this wild, crazy elephant full of power. And the soft, gentle, compassionate Buddha. It was like high noon as the two approached each other. Who would win? I'm sure if that was in Australia, they'd be taking bets on who would win. It's $2 on the Buddha, $1.50 on the elephant. But anyway, as they came closer together, about to approach, the Buddha, as I often say, had enormous psychic powers. If you get into deep meditation, it's amazing what power you know you have. That Buddha, if he wanted to, could have grabbed the elephant by the trunk before the elephant knew what was going on, and picked him up and swirled him 3 times around his head and thrown the elephant 300 miles over the Ganges River. That would be easy for a Buddha to do. Now, all these supermen, super Batman and Iron Man and who is the other men and whatever you got these days. And you got girls as well, Wonder Woman. I saw it on the newspaper, on the In-Flight magazine. They have all these superheroes. You know, I used to read them in the comics. The Buddha's much stronger than those people. So it's actually so much that we've got this tradition in Buddhism of having like Buddhist monks who meditate and nuns with super normal powers. You know, that's why it's about time. You know, you've had Iron Man, Wonder Woman, Catwoman, Batman. Who else have you got? Got Batwoman yet? I don't know. But all these, apparently they're really, really good for making movies. And people make millions out of these movies. So, Super Monk should be the next movie. And of course the sequel would have to be Super Nun, starring Sister Gotami. As Super Nun. Da-da-da, flies through the air and stops the terrorists blowing up aircraft. You can have a lot of fun with this. And I've said this on the internet quite a few times, and of course, I think we still got this Super Monk cartoon book over in the kitchen somewhere. So it's a really nice book for someone in Budapest for their art project. They did a cartoon, Super Monk. And it's, instead of calling it action comics, they call it no action comics. It's very Buddhist. It's very brilliant. But anyway, these people do have psychic powers. So there's the Buddha. And he could have done that. But Buddhist monks, or especially Buddhas with psychic powers, we don't use violence. Even though you could. You just don't do violence at all. Instead, he did loving kindness. Now that is the real superpower. That's why if we did have Super Monk in the movies, there would be no violence. You find another way of solving problems. There'd be no sex either. That's probably why they haven't made a movie about Super Monk. No sex, no violence, no box office receipts. Even as I said recently, that somebody showed me from the internet that Sarah Jessica Parker from Sex and the City has been reading my book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. So, you know, once she's a disciple, then I expect an invitation to do a cameo performance on Sex and the City. I thought that'd be very interesting to appear on Sex and the City as a Buddhist monk. I don't know exactly what I'd do. But maybe that episode they could actually change it to no sex in the monastery. But anyhow, let's go back to the meeting Nalagiri. So what the Buddha meeting Nalagiri. So what the Buddha did, he just gave this incredibly powerful loving kindness. Nalagiri, the door of my heart is totally open to you. No matter what you ever do. If you want, you can pick me up with your trunk and smash my body against the tree. And I will love you no less. You can trample me under your enormous feet. But Nalagiri, the door of my heart, will always be open to you. I will always love you, care for you, respect you, no matter what you ever do. And with that incredibly powerful loving kindness, totally unconditioned, there's only one possibility. And that was Nalagiri just stopping in front of the Buddha, putting his head down, and the Buddha just stroking his trunk. There, Nalagiri, it's okay. That is power. That is wisdom power. So if you're going crazy in this meditation, remember Nalagiri and the Buddha. Just say, crazy mind, the door of my heart is totally open to you. You can send me into some asylum. You can drive me crazy. You can hurt me. You can kill me. But the door of my heart is totally open to you, mind of mine. And what will happen next? As if your crazy mind will be bowing in front of you. You're just stroking it there. There you go, mind. You're okay. That is wisdom power. That is what overcomes obstacles in meditation. And no matter what stage you are in meditation, whether you're the nimitta stage about to get into jhana, whether you're the beautiful breath, where you're just in the present moment awareness, always use that wisdom power. You can never underestimate the power of such unconditional loving kindness during meditation. It always works. Why? Because when you're doing unconditional loving kindness, number one, you're not judging. It's no good, no bad. Look, me, mind, my whole body, my meditation, door of my heart's open. I don't care what you are. You're a great meditator, stupid meditator. I don't care. I'm not going to judge you. I totally accept you. The door of my heart's open to you. Straight away, you have peace. Stillness. The whole cause of restlessness has been undermined. You have this beautiful kindness which engages with things. If you want to know how can you keep your attention on the object, not willpower, wisdom power, kindness. Whatever you're kind to is kind back to you. If you have a little rabbit and you're always kind to that rabbit, when the rabbit sees you, it comes towards you, wants to spend time with you, because of kindness. If you're kind to your mind, as soon as the mind sees you, it runs towards you with its tail wagging and jumps all over you. That is how we keep one-pointedness, this beautiful loving kindness. Many, many years ago, I was doing my breath meditation, and like many of you, it was sort of peaceful, but it was dry. You could watch the breath, but nothing much was happening. It didn't have this oomph to it. And I just decided, why not combine loving kindness meditation with breath meditation? Ah, it was just terrific evening. I'll never forget that. Evening. That was actually, Bianca, one of the Safety Bay retreats, a long time ago. And did loving kindness onto my breathing. Breath, you've been just coming into my body ever since I was born, and taking all these waste products out of my body. And you've been doing that. I've never thanked you. I never appreciated all the hard work you've done. Breath, I really care for you. Thank you so much for all the hard work you've done. Without fail, even I've been busy, I've been sick, been sleeping, you've still been working without fail. I just had this beautiful feeling of loving kindness towards my breath. Breath, the door of my heart is totally open to you. I'm not just going to take you for granted anymore. I'm going to value, care for you, respect you. And as soon as those thoughts arose, oh, my breath became so beautiful, so delightful. And the next thing I knew, whew, I was in some great meditations. I remember that night because I did go to sleep, but I dreamt of jhanas. If you want to have a really good dream, those are the very best. You're dreaming of being in the greatest bliss state you can possibly have. So, try loving kindness onto your breathing, onto whatever else you're doing. And you'll find it's so easy to stay with your breath. And if you haven't developed the delight, you know, of the breath, because some of you say in the interviews, yeah, you can watch the breath, but you know, it disappears, it doesn't feel delightful, it's got no oomph to it, it's got no joy to it. And Ajahn Brahm keeps on saying, oh, it's so nice, it's so wonderful, but yeah, it's sort of okay, but nothing like that. Try the loving kindness on it. And when you do the loving kindness, go for broke, don't hold back. Have incredible loving kindness. You may all have somebody or something you really care for. Maybe your little kid. It may be sort of a rabbit. It may be a cat. It may even be, you know, a husband. Well, that's pretty rare. But, oh my. But it may be someone you really care for, something you really, really love. Make that thing your breath. And you just transfer these feelings of loving kindness onto your breathing. And then you find, oh, it's just so easy to watch your breath when you care for it. And it becomes all sorts of soft and lovely, and oh, you're just having a wonderful time. Just because to develop the deep meditations, you have to develop emotions. The way into the deep meditations is an emotional journey. Not a thinking journey. The joy you experience, which I keep talking about, is an emotion. It's part of the mind rather than part of the rational mind. And because sometimes you think, how on earth can the breath be beautiful? But it feels beautiful. You have this emotional ability to arouse joy and let the joy come. One of the reasons people are afraid of emotions is because it makes you out of control. Exactly. You just send this emotional, not roller coaster, emotional soaring high rocket flight into the jhanas. So peaceful, so joyful, so wonderful. Let it happen. I know that some people think, oh, in Buddhism we're not supposed to have emotions. Of course we're supposed to have emotions, the positive ones, the negative ones, the ones we're supposed to be getting rid of. You know, the anger, the grief, the cravings, the lust, all that sort of stuff. But the inspirations, the joys, the love, the loving kindness, the piti sukha of deep meditation, those are emotional highs. So allow those to happen. So just watching the breath, and oh, you have this beautiful sense of loving kindness towards the breath. And the breath just smiles back at you. And then it's no longer a problem anymore. You find you're just spinning out way into the jhanas. It's so lovely and so easy. So you can never do enough loving kindness. On your body, on your mind, on your food, or whatever it is you're doing. And it works. So that's one of the other ways of overcoming the obstacles in meditation. The last one I want to say, before I run out of time, as you're going through the meditations, you know that I start off with present moment awareness. Sometimes, I'm just being personal, sometimes I'm meditating and it's not sort of developing. I think, just what am I doing wrong? And one of the things, loving kindness is one of the first things I do to overcome the problems. And the other thing I do is just sharpening my focus in the present moment. Because I find that, yeah, I get present moment awareness in the beginning of the meditation, but as I'm developing the meditation, I sometimes lose my focus. Just like you've got a camera, and you're looking through the camera, and it's just slightly blurred, slightly out of focus. And I find that maybe I'm just watching an image or something, and I'm slightly out of focus. I'm not sharply in the present moment. You've got a little blur, you're a little bit off into the future, or a little bit lingering in the past. But all I need to do is remind myself, just to focus present moment. Okay, come really sharply into this moment. Absolutely no future, absolutely no past. And as soon as I focus in the present moment, then whoosh, it just goes straight the way through and into the deep meditations. Because whenever there's a slight perception of the future, there'll be some expectations, some wanting, some desires, or sometimes even fears. But if you're right smack bang in the present moment, you can't have fears. Fear is always about what might happen next. Expectations is hoping it might happen. But when you're really, really, really focused in this moment, you can't have those things. When you focus in the present moment, you haven't got a clue where you've come from. You're totally free of the past. So sometimes that's all what I do, just metaphorically, just sharpen the focus of my mind. So it's totally in the present moment. And that solves a lot of the hindrances in meditation. And of course, I usually do that towards the end of the meditation, or rather when you start to get into the deep states. But you can do that any time. You can always sharpen the focus in the present moment. And then when you realize what you're doing, you're really giving your mind that extra bit of power. You can always do some loving kindness, caring for this moment, caring for your breath, even caring for your nimitta. You've got a nimitta comes up. Don't try and control it. Respect it, love it, be kind to it. This little nimitta is coming, maybe for the first time, and it's as shy as you are shy. So no, be kind to it. Just like sometimes you guys come to the interviews, and I don't know why that some of you are afraid of seeing a monk. You ask everybody else, I've never hit anybody. I am probably the softest of the monks you'll ever come and meet. I don't know why people are afraid of having an interview with me. I'll never tell you off, and I'll never tell your secrets to other people, except that woman who came and told me about... No, I won't do that. So you're totally safe. And of course, that's my job, being a teacher, to create that sort of relationship by having so much kindness that you feel safe, welcome and respected when you come to the interview times with me. And this is exactly what you're doing in meditation too. You're welcome this moment. And then this moment won't be afraid of you. When nimittas come, they're not afraid of you. You think you're afraid of nimittas. Imagine what the nimittas feel. Look at them as other little beings. They've come to see you for the first time. They come to visit. They're shy. Give them a break. Give them some kindness. Yeah, you can come in if you want. Yeah, if you want to go, you can go. And then they come and stay with you. It's all about the attitude which you develop in meditation. That's why it's not what you're experiencing, it's how you're experiencing it. Develop the right attitude, the make peace, the kindness, the gentleness, focusing in this moment, not judging. You see, all those are very, very beautiful attitudes. These are wisdom teachings, not willpower teachings. And you find that they will take you into the deepest of meditations. That is how to overcome the obstacles in meditation and many of the obstacles in life. And this hour's gone by already. Amazing how fast it goes. Is there any comments or questions before we finish? If there are any questions, put them on a piece of paper and I'll answer them tonight. And in the meantime, have a wonderful day. See what happens. Remember, no judging though. Sadhu. Sadhu. Wait for it.
Sadhu. Okay, very good. Very good.